You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of November 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
We are back by popular demand. Virginia, we have witnessed yet another Democratic sweep today.
Virginia votes among other American jurisdictions. Is it already time for Republicans across the United States to start heading for the lifeboats? My guests Mary Dajewski and Michael Goldfarb will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including new powers for Vladimir Putin's National Guard. Are they a protection force or a protection racket? Pretty vacancy, pretty Patel that is, or so we assume as the downfall of another British minister is anticipated after another bizarre day in UK politics, and when will powerful figures learn that seeking to suppress information online is the best way to broadcast it? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Dajewski, the columnist for The Independent and The Guardian, and Michael Goldfarb, the journalist and broadcaster. Welcome both. Now, 1 year ago today, the people of the United States confounded all predictions and most received notions of common sense by electing to their presidency Donald Trump. 1 year later, this experiment has been put to its first large-scale electoral verdict, and the result seems to suggest a measure of equivocation. In Virginia and New Jersey, Democrat governors were elected despite the president's urging. Also in Virginia, Democrats made big gains in the House of Delegates, among them Danica Roem, who becomes the first transgender politician to be elected in American history. Michael, first of all, is this really a repudiation of Trump, or in the case of Virginia especially, is it just an extension of a local trend we've seen in Virginia for some time, that the state is becoming more Democratic?
No, I think this is actually a serious repudiation, not just of Trump, but of what we call Trumpism, you know, that full panoply of alt-right, white supremacist, make America great, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, kind of white, you know, the white people are taking their own back. What happened in Virginia last night, it's been very interesting, is, first of all, the youth came out. One of the notable things about last year's shock defeat, and let's not forget that, I mean, Hillary Clinton did actually win 3 million more votes, but the shocking facts were that youth did not come out across the country in great number. The African-American vote was down a little bit. But in Virginia, both groups came out, and particularly 18 to 29-year-olds. She carried the state last year by 5 points. Northam won the state, who has just been elected governor, by 9 points. That's nearly doubled the vote, and almost all of that is down to the youth vote. And that's really important to remember. That said, it's still just a state. Virginia has been going Democrat for a couple of decades now. And on the broader scale of things, the last thing before I went to bed last night, being, you know, 5 hours ahead, I wasn't going to stay up all night for Virginia. Trust me. I love her. Virginia, I love you, but I'm not going to stay up all night for you. Was earlier in the week, there'd been a poll that showed that Trump had a 37% approval rating, by far the lowest approval rating at this point in a presidency in history. And then yesterday, CNN had a poll showing only about 38% of Americans approve of the Democratic Party. So there was this weird balance. I put that up on Facebook, went to bed, not knowing who was going to win. And now, you know, all politics is local. Good on the local organizers in Virginia. Charlottesville really had an effect. They came out in mobs. The students did in Charlottesville after last summer's outrage. And so that's sort of the picture. Yes, a repudiation of Trump, but let's not get carried away that this is the beginning of the end of the beginning, if I can mangle Churchill's words.
Mary, Donald Trump did, of course, noisily endorse Ed Gillespie, the Republican candidate in Virginia, and equally inevitably, Donald Trump has now quite publicly thrown Gillespie under the bus, said it was all his fault he lost because he didn't embrace Trump's vision, if we're going to call it that tightly enough. But is it possible, with all due acknowledgement that there may be a measure of wishful thinking in this question, that Trump is kind of becoming electoral poison, that if he endorses somebody, they're basically done for?
I'm not sure that I would want to use Virginia as the bellwether in this particular circumstance, because I think that, we lived in Washington, D.C. for 5 years in the late 90s, and it was quite clear that Virginia, then it was already a swing state, and it was moving, as just been said, towards the Democrats. So I think that's a trend which we may have seen accelerated in the latest results. The question is whether it applies also across the heartland and across rural America, which was really Trump's fiefdom in the end. And I'm not sure that we can say that yet.
What do you think, Michael? Is there an anti-Midas touch at work here? Because quite a lot of the results have been irresistibly symbolic, quite apart from Danica Roem, who beat Bob Marshall, who described himself as Virginia's chief homophobe. The new mayor of Hoboken, New Jersey, is a Sikh. Philadelphia's new district attorney is a lawyer who has previously represented Black Lives Matter. Quite a lot of this couldn't have gone any worse from the point of view of Trump or the Trumpists.
The Steve Bannon followers, you know, the Breitbart readers. I think we need to have a better selection. This is, you know, it's odd. Usually, next year we'll see more elections in state houses for governorships than this year. I mean, Virginia and New Jersey are about the only ones, there's one other, I think, that actually have a gubernatorial election in the year after the presidential. I don't know. I think that we need to see a lot more, results. But what is interesting is if you look back to the recent primary in Alabama between two Republicans, the Attorney General Jeff Sessions left the Senate mm-hmm. to serve in the Trump cabinet, and Trump backed one guy, and it was the other guy who won, Roy Moore. So there's another example of Trump. But I think that we don't quite understand his appeal to his base, the people who stay with him. I mean, it's been a year since he was elected. It was shocking. Nothing in his behavior has shown that he's capable of, you know, broadening his appeal, stepping up, becoming presidential. That has had no effect on about 90% of the people who voted for him. They would vote for him again today. And it's entirely possible the result would be the same if you had the election today. So I go back to what I was saying earlier. I do think that the Trump effect on the Republican Party is, you know, they're still buying his act. They buy him. But what he has done, clearly, if out of fear, if nothing else, not ideology. I mean, Northam is no Bernie Sanders. The kids voted for Bernie Sanders. They didn't vote for Hillary. They now understand that, you know, we live in an age where you might want some ideological or policy positions from the Democratic Party that you're never going to get. But if you don't vote for the Democrats, you will get a Trump. You will get some kind of, you know, white supremacist sympathizer, if not active. And so they will come out.
I think one thing that in mentioning the youth vote that actually came out, this election has really, the elections yesterday, that they've reopened a question that's always been around ever since Trump's election, which is how far is Trump, as it were, the last gasp of white, rural, discriminated against, as it feels, America? And how far is it possibly the beginning of a trend? And if you look at the youth vote this time around and you look at the demographic of America, you could see Trump as the last gasp, the last hanging on of old-style white rural America rather than the shape of the future. But, of course, that might just be wishful thinking.
Okay, well, let's take a look now at Russia, specifically closely at President Vladimir Putin's idea to expand the powers of the National Guard, an elite military force launched last year under the supervision of Viktor Zolotov, a former bodyguard of Putin. If a bill before Russia's parliament survives the rigorous scrutiny of Russia's lawmakers, and it seems reasonable to assume that it might, the National Guard will also assume responsibility for protecting Russia's regional governors. Putin has appointed a new generation of governors ahead of March's presidential election, which he is believed to stand a decent chance of winning. Mary, first of all, to the expansion of powers to protect the new governors, what manner of protection actually is this? Is this protection of the governors from outside threats of the protection of the sort that nice little governorship you have here, you wouldn't want anything to happen to it?
Well, I dare say that regional governors have always, ever since they were reinvented under Putin, that they've always enjoyed a degree of protection. The question is where they got it from. Often they would have been in a position to hire their own private guards. So I think there's two ways of looking at this. I mean, the one way of looking at it, which is, as it were, the consensus from outside Russia, from the West, is to say, well, the National Guard itself, when it was set up 18 months ago, was a thoroughly bad idea, that it was all designed for repression on the streets in the event of further protests, to protect the president for in the event that other forces of law and order maybe weren't completely loyal. Then there would be, as it were, this elite force which would protect the president and important people against, as it were, the people. But I think there's another way of looking at it as well, which is that law and order in Russia, you look at the police, you look at the internal troops, which were the people who were brought out in the event of street protests, and they've generally been a very old-fashioned, undisciplined, sort of brutish, sort of unprofessional group. And you could see the development of a National Guard as being an attempt to professionalise and modernise, to have, as it were, a proper elite protection force, like most other countries have. So I wouldn't absolutely go for the negative version exclusively.
Until they rename themselves the Black Hundreds.
What do you think, Michael? Is this something relatively benign, I guess, a Russian equivalent of the Secret Service, or is Vladimir Putin attempting to establish a parallel military answerable only to him?
I'm sure it's a little bit of both. I mean, I'm interested to hear Mary take a fairly sanguine view, but then I mean, who knows? I mean, we haven't even seen numbers. How many numbers? There's a dozen of these governors. What, are they going to get 10 bodyguards to do, you know, to take it in shifts? Are they going to get 1,000 each? 1,000 each, I'm a little worried. 100 each, probably still a little worried. On the other hand, it is Russia. People do turn up in a condition other than alive, frequently. And it is interesting to think, Andrew, that the conversations that Vladimir Putin could have with previous governors, saying, okay, we'll give you the governorship. And they have a negotiation, how much you can skim, how much you're allowed to, you know, drag out of the budget, you know, done businessmen in your province for. And out of that money, you pay for your own protection. Now he's professionalizing it, if Mary is correct, saying you don't have to pay for your protection now, I'll pay for it. And you just are not allowed to take as much of the skim. I mean, it's like a mafia, you know, in that respect. But, you know, at one level, I think we all demonize him quite a lot. And although I think most of his actions in the world are demonic, there's also an element that we miss, I think, inside Russia. His popularity, Mary, correct me if I'm wrong, is sincere. I mean, it isn't, you know, beaten into people via Pravda and Izvestia anymore, and the KGB knocking on your door at 4 a.m. These are people who do see him as a fine representative of all that's great about Russia.
And that's largely because stability has been brought after pretty much 20 years of pretty much chaos for a lot of people.
Well, on that subject of stability then, does Putin have fears, reasonable or otherwise, of disruption or upheaval around the election?
Well, I think those fears have been around on two grounds. First of all, because there were street protests after Putin said that he was going to stand for president again. 2011-2012, there were street protests first about the parliamentary elections, and then because Putin was going to stand again. So they can look at those and say, well, yes, we want to prevent anything of that sort of disorder happening in relation to future elections. But they can also look, and this is probably a view from outside rather than from in Russia, I think it's true that the impact of events, especially in Ukraine and especially in Kiev, where when their last president, Viktor Yanukovych, fled, I mean, there was disorder on the streets and there was anarchy and there was chaos and there was nobody in charge for periods of sort of 24 hours at a time. And it's that I think Putin and all the people alongside him in the Kremlin, they have in their mind's eye, is that picture of disorder, of Kiev being out of control.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Michael Goldfarb and Mary Dajewski. Coming up next, another one of those days in British politics.
For November, Monocle heads into the season of mists and mellow fruitfulness, boldly going beyond the chocolate box with a big old trip to Switzerland. Uphill and down valley, our team trekked and tobogganed to bring you the extra thick cream of the crop, the cities and villages, designers, chefs, businesses and opportunities that set these fair cantons apart. Elsewhere in the pages, it's business as usual, which means highly unusual. Where else are you going to get a report from Iceland's strategic airbase? A tour bus diary from the Coptic Pope as he plays to packed crowds of believers in Melbourne? A report from the growing independence movement in the Faroe Islands? Or a trip to meet the artists ensuring Jeddah stays Saudi Arabia's most liberal city? Some extra cherries on the cake come in the form of the tour of two halves of the Yves Saint Laurent museums in Paris and Marrakesh, an absolutely gorgeous house in Tasmania that we're all fighting over to stay at, and a whistle-stop tour of the International Baking Renaissance. Now there's a sentence that makes the cake to put the cherry on in the first place. Full circle. Switzerland's wonders never cease. Monocle's November issue is out now.
And you are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Millister. With me are Michael Goldfarb and Mary Dajewski. Now, for professional and amateur observers of UK politics, there hasn't been a day quite like today since the former mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, argued with journalists about Hitler after locking himself inside a disabled toilet. An entire media and political class has been hunched over flightradar24.com, tracking the progress of the Kenya Airways jet believed to be returning Priti Patel, Secretary of State for International Development, back from Nairobi to a presumed meeting with no tea or biscuits with an enraged Prime Minister over unauthorised contacts with officialdom Patel had while on holiday in Israel. And if none of that makes any sense at all, it's only because none of it makes any sense at all. Now, as we go to air, Michael, first of all, she remains as yet unsacked. Is there a simple way, in about 20 seconds or less, in which you can explain what she's done wrong?
Yes, she took meetings when she was allegedly on holiday starting with Bibi Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel.
Well, who among us, Michael, has not gone on holiday to Israel and had a meeting with the Prime Minister?
Well, you know, I went there for work. I couldn't get a meeting with him. Maybe I should have just gone on a tourist visa. And then she took several subsequent meetings and a trip onto the Golan Heights, all without informing the Foreign and Commonwealth Office or taking the British ambassador with her. She was so far outside of channels and normal behavior that in days of yore, like last government yore, she would have been sacked for freelancing on her own. Now, I'm sure that there are actually many examples that are locked away in the archives out at Kew of, you know, one cabinet minister being tipped the wink by a prime minister to do a bit of freelancing and report back behind the back of the foreign secretary. Fine, do it. But don't get caught. she got caught. And when you get caught, don't have to keep changing your story, which she's been doing over the last 48 hours. Clearly, what's happened, I mean, because today we find out from Stephen Pollard, who's the editor of the
Jewish
Chronicle.
This is in the Jewish Chronicle.
That, in fact, Theresa May knew this was going on.
Well, Downing Street is denying that, but then, of course,
I guess they would.
Mary, does it strike you that anything genuinely treacherous afoot is here, or is this just left hand and right hand being unaware of what each other are doing?
Well, I think it's a lot about left and right hand not being aware of what each other are
other,
doing.
Other portions of the human anatomy I could have mentioned.
But the question is, well, there are two questions. One of them is that what does it say about British foreign policy and how British foreign policy is organised and run that you can actually
British
have
foreign policy
two
is organised and run.
You can have the Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson doing one thing and appearing to represent one thing, or maybe just Boris Johnson, and then you have the International Development Secretary doing something else, apparently without his knowledge, and protocol requires that any minister, not just a minister that has to do with abroad, like international development, but any minister who goes outside the country has to inform the Foreign Office, because they need to give sort of diplomatic accompaniment. They need to do all the things and make sure that protocol is kept. And there are all those things that have to be done. So to go, as it were, under the radar on holiday and have official meetings, you know, it's the sort of thing that if I were analysing other countries, it's the sort of thing you look for to say, ah, there are splits in the leadership, they don't know what they're doing, or there is, as it were...
Well, there are splits in the leadership, and they don't know what they're doing.
Or there is a foreign policy B, which is being pursued alongside the official foreign policy, sort of officially. And I'm sort of uncomfortable about this story from the very beginning, because it's very hard to accept that nobody here knew that Priti Patel was spending this amount of time in Israel, meeting the people she was meeting, without somebody actually deliberately turning a blind eye because they wanted that to happen.
Well, first of all, what is MI6 doing? Second of all, to pick up on what Mary was saying, pretty clearly we all know that Theresa May keeps Boris Johnson, the foreign secretary, in the cabinet on sufferance. She hates the man, he probably hates her, and she appointed him foreign secretary for whatever reason, probably
to get him out of the country,
as often as possible. So it isn't an unlikely thing that she might tip a nod in the wink to Priti Patel to engage in a little off-the-books conversations with the Israeli leadership. And the cover is, well, we want to give... Then this is an important thing, because the other thing to say is, if this was happening in almost any country you can think of, except Israel, mm-hmm. it would be a nothing burger. But here we have this situation where, yes, she went to this military hospital on the Golan Heights, which Britain doesn't recognize Israel's occupation of the Golan, but in this military hospital on the Golan Heights, Israeli doctors are actually tending the grievously sick and wounded pouring out of Syria from the civil war. So, that's noble. But on the other hand, all of the diplomacy on it is wrong. It's just wrong. And you think, one, how is it the foreign secretary doesn't have his own sources of information so that he could have nipped this in the bud? I mean, this is the sort of thing that...
But she said at the beginning that the Foreign Office did know that she was going, and I'm not completely convinced, even though she reversed that later in
on
her
holiday?
Apology.
Everybody knows. It's too hot in August.
Nonetheless, I'm still not convinced that any of these versions are necessarily true or untrue as they're currently presented.
So you go for the utter chaos theory?
Always. Always. She has not, I've just checked again, still not as yet sacked. But that is where we must end Patel Watch for this evening. And finally tonight, to move on to some recent examples of the Streisand effect. That's that law of online discourse named in honour of the singer's unsuccessful efforts to keep pictures of her house off the internet, which suggests that the harder a person or entity works to suppress information about a certain thing, the further and faster that information will spread. The Disney Corporation Corporation has been compelled by widespread outrage and a boycott by other outlets to rescind its ban on Los Angeles Times journalists from its advanced screenings, and the popular warbler Taylor Swift has attempted to silence a disobliging blog, thereby ensuring vast readership for it. Mary, why will people not learn? Why will people not learn? You might as well just put up a billboard saying, there is this thing that I wish everybody didn't know about me.
Because they still persist in the idea that they will be the exception and they will be able to keep whatever it is under wraps, out of the news, deniable or whatever. And they still do. And as you say, I don't know why they do it. And especially, you know, in the last 5-10 years, social media has made this even less feasible than it was before.
Taylor Swift, Michael, took umbrage with something somebody wrote about her music. This made me slightly nervous as somebody who came up through rock criticism myself. It was someone wrote a provocative, if somewhat silly, article about Taylor Swift, saying that they had identified certain alt-right tropes in her music and video. And I suppose if you look hard enough at almost anything, you can find something. But why would Taylor Swift, who is clearly not stupid, and clearly does understand how the media landscape operates, choose to make a thing out of a thing which maybe, I don't know, a few thousand people would have read and forgotten about if she just ignored it?
Well, I think partially because a few thousand people may have read it, but, you know, the old line, right? A lie is halfway around the world before the truth can get its pants on. And now, with Twitter, lies simply circle the earth like, you know, junk satellites in perpetuity until eventually gravity pulls them down. And I think in Taylor Swift's case, she was probably trying to get ahead of the curve on that. You know, 1,000 people read the article originally, but it only takes one person putting it out there out of context. And of course, now with 240 characters, nothing is out of context. We can put quotation marks.
280, Michael. 280. Unless you're on some ration.
I'm on
now.
A special ration.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've been dieting, Andrew. I have. I really have. So I mean, I'm sympathetic to that. Less sympathetic to the LA Times, because I mean, to the LA Times, to Disney. I mean, what the one thing we know about showbiz is it's built entirely on the idea that there's no such thing as bad publicity. Well, maybe Harvey Weinstein would be an argument against. But by and large, you know, if you get, so long as people are talking about Disney films, it doesn't matter. Because sometimes people will say, well, I don't believe the critics either. And they'll go and see some piece of garbage that the critics warned them about. And I just think it's a huge mistake for any big institutional entity. And this is the difference between Disney and Taylor Swift, to even begin to take on this aspect of the press, to try and push it down, whether you're reporting on their business, because then it's all going to come out, or whether you're talking about their products.
I mean, I can remember a couple of PR corporations trying to pull a similar stunt back when I was a rock journalist, and possibly rather pathetically, it just made us all the keener, Mary, to gang up on absolutely all their artists.
No, absolutely. But I also think that there is a sense in which Hollywood has been able to dictate the terms of its coverage, at least as far as interviews with particular stars are concerned. You know, they are surrounded by protective PRs, and in order to get interviews with them, if you want an interview with them, then often they dictate the terms on which those interviews happen. They want to read the completed interview before it's published or view it, and they want to clear any quotations that you may have used. Now, some of us are in the fortunately luxurious position of being able to turn down interviews on those terms, or our newspapers or whatever do it for us. But that's not a luxury available to every showbiz reporter. And that is a tradition, and I think it's absolutely pernicious.
Indeed. Well, that does bring us to the end of today's show. Priti Patel still not sacked. Just checking that again there for you. Mary Dajewski and Michael Goldfarb, thank you for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Tom Hall, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Chloe Carnesis. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Music next at 1900. It's The Entrepreneurs with Matt Alagaya, and there's more on the day's big stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. I'll be your host for that. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.